Welcome to a special session of Behind the Evidence, a podcast sponsored by the Graykin Center for Addiction at Boston Medical Center. I'm Mark LaRochelle, a co-host of the podcast and an addiction-focused primary care physician and health services researcher at Boston Medical Center. I'm recording this episode today at the second annual Together for Hope conference sponsored by the Graykin Center for Addiction. I'm joined here with more than 900 clinicians, researchers, policymakers, harm reduction practitioners, advocates, and people with lived experience from across Massachusetts and the region. We've all gathered here in Worcester for 2 days to try and move our work forward and make lives better for people affected by substance use. In this episode, we'll bring you a series of conversations with presenters at our conference. A little different than our typical long-form conversation with an author of a published peer-reviewed manuscript. I found this conference to be tremendously affirming and energizing, and I hope these conversations do the same for you. And so without further ado, we'll get right to the content. I'm excited now to be with Dr. Devita Schiff, who was in a plenary session talking about how to better support parents who use substance use. Devita, could you introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, thanks, Mark. It's a treat to be here and talk with you. My name is Devita Schiff. I'm a pediatrician and addiction medicine physician at Mass General, where I'm the director of perinatal and family-based substance use disorder care.
Excellent. And one of the first things that you talked about in your session was a change in a reporting law in Massachusetts about reporting substance-exposed individuals in newborns in particular. So could you tell us about the change in the law?
Yeah, so in December of 2024, we, as part of years of advocacy work and kind of collective work across multiple state agencies, now have removed the language in the 51A statute that says an infant who's born physically dependent upon an addictive drug at birth has to be reported for a time of delivery. And so now we're in a context where if there's no acute safety concerns around parenting, then a provider has the discretion to make a decision about whether a report is filed at time of delivery.
Excellent. And so you all talked about some of the trade-offs in making this change. Could you describe those for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So research that we and others have done have described that when you don't reflexively mandatory report, particularly people who are receiving medications to treat opioid use disorder, the recommended medication for pregnancy and non-pregnant individuals, that you improve patient-provider trust. It encourages disclosure and care seeking, and it allows us to reduce the unnecessary referrals to the Child Protective Services system, which we know is already overburdened and understaffed. Some concerns as we think about how to move forward in the new legislative context is that we know it's subject to institutional and provider bias, and it really puts the burden on the healthcare provider to predict risk and future risk.
Excellent. And so, you know, thinking through it as I was sitting in the audience, it seems like these would be really difficult decisions to make. And very helpfully, you've come up with a framework to help us in making these decisions. And I was wondering if you could quickly walk us through that.
Yeah, happy to. What we did was we really went to the foundations of the principles of harm reduction and tried to think about how does this apply not just to a, you know, single individual or a birthing person, but how does that those principles align when we're thinking about parenting and a child. And from that, we came up with five domains. The domains that we think through are what was the safety of the child. So for specifically when and where and how did that substance use happen? Was the child present when the substance use happened? We think about the safety of that use as a parent using alone. We want to understand how that parent is currently engaging in treatment. Are they asking for treatment? Are they endorsing current use? And then are they willing to escalate treatment services? So do they are they willing to come to the clinic more frequently? Are they willing to have home visiting services? Are they willing to touch base with other recovery supports? We think about the stability of the home environment, and then we also think about the ways in which structural determinants of health, including structural racism, impact those decisions that we might make around filing. So how did this parent's identity, power, privilege, or bias affect our decision? And we go through each case of a disclosure of parental substance use and a caregiver who's actively taking care of a child, and we think through each of those questions and collectively make a decision about whether we think there's an opportunity to optimize services for these families, including home visiting supports, medical and addiction treatment, recovery services, or whether we think that there's imminent harm or danger to a child.
Excellent. Super helpful. So how are we going to know if this change is helping people?
Yeah. So actually in the statutory language of the revised mandated reporting bill, there's actually a requirement for an evaluation that's led by the Department of Public Health. And what's really exciting about this proposed evaluation is that it's going to require our Department of Children and Families to put data into a public health data warehouse, data set you know really well, that will allow us to actually really ask this question of what were we doing before, how are we doing now, and what does the sort of future look like, and guide our future implementation and potential changes based on real data, which will be really exciting.
Excellent. Thanks so much for chatting.
Thanks, Mark.
Now I'm with Dr. Jenny Zendwan and Dr. Maddie Castile, and I'm at their poster they titled Demographic and Clinical Characteristics Associated with Substance Use Treatment and Mortality Rates Among Latino Men in Central Massachusetts. I'll first ask you to each introduce yourself. Jenny, can you tell us about yourself?
Yeah, sure. My name is Jenny. I'm a clinical psychologist and assistant professor at Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital.
Awesome. And Maddie?
Maddie is a primary care physician who retired this past October, but over the last 9.5 years, I've been the Commissioner of Health and Human Services for the City of Worcester.
Awesome. So this study came out of analyzing folks who've been to Hector Reyes' house, and I was wondering, Maddie, if you could tell us about that program and its history.
So the history of the program is back in 2004, there was a lot of violence in the community, as people would say that there was violence in the community. And so at that time, the Congressman Jim McGovern put a meeting together to figure out what we can do. One of the things that we found out was that substance use was one of the major problems in the community. There was a gentleman named Hector Reyes who he himself suffered with substance use, and one of his goals was to put a treatment facility for Latino men. He felt that Latino men would go to other programs and didn't feel comfortable, wasn't comfortable with the food, the language, and wanted to put something together that Latinos would feel comfortable. In 2009, we opened the program, a 25-bed residential treatment facility for Latino men that has medical care. So we have providers from UMass that provide psychiatry. I provided primary care, and I'm missing, infectious disease we also have, which continue on to this day. Since then, one of the things that we when we started the program, we realized that people, a lot of them didn't have a high school degree, that a lot of them came in when they were homeless, that job training they didn't have. And we started a transition house right next to the program because they couldn't afford the rates of what rent was. But then when they were living in that transition house, they couldn't get jobs. And so part of the piece was that they needed some job training program. So we opened up in 2015 a job training program called Cafe Reyes, which is on Shrewsbury Street, which still exists till today. And then most recently, I want to say, I don't remember now the year, they have another transitional house, again, for people who graduate the program, trying to help them get a job and all of that, but then to be able to, it's a transitional house, it's named Maddie's House, and so it's to get people, settled in and be able to get jobs and move on their own.
That is so fantastic. Love that. Jenny, can you tell us what you did for the data you have you're sharing today?
Yeah, sure. I met Maddie about 2 years ago because we were both panelists for the Department of Public Health, where we're talking about strategies to combat opioid overdoses in Latino men and Latino communities here in Massachusetts. So Latino men are disproportionately dying from opioid overdoses, and particularly in Central Mass, there's a higher risk of opioid overdoses for Latino men. And when I met Maddie in person, I just really wanted to meet her. And the first thing she told me was like, you're a researcher, help me research something. And I was like, sure. And that's how this project came along. And so some of the questions that we both had is like, why are people dying at disproportionate rates? Latinos that are going through the program, through Hector Reyes, are also, even after they leave the program, we later found out that a lot of them are dying, a significant number of people are dying from overdoses. So two questions are like, who are at greater risk of dying from opioid overdoses? And the second question is like, what clinical and demographic characteristics are associated with better treatment outcomes and mortality risk? So what we did was we got data from BSAS, administrative data from BSAS, spanning 10 years on all the men that have entered and exited the program. And we looked at some of the clinical and demographic characteristics. What we found is that people who enter the program with a source of income, whether it's Social Security, disability, whether they had a job that they could return to, had better treatment outcome, meaning that they were better able to complete the treatment, but also less likely to return quickly after being discharged. So being able to stay sober if they wanted to stay sober. In terms of opioid mortality risk, the Spanish speakers were less likely to die from opioid overdoses.
Interesting.
And this is pretty consistent with the acculturation literature, that the more Latinos are acculturated, the rates of use and severity and chronicity are similar to white populations. The good part is that if they were enrolled 2 or more times in Hector Reyes, they were less likely to also die from overdoses. So one of the things that Maddie and I are trying to figure out is like how to make the environment welcoming enough where they can feel safe, they'll return if they need more support. And if they completed treatment, they were also less likely to die from overdoses.
That's fantastic. And so what do you think we should do with this information?
So what we're doing right now is we're in the qualitative phase where we're asking men with lived experience that are in the program or have long left the program or recently left the program to help us interpret this. So we understand that we're not the experts. They are the experts, and they're going to tell us what we need to do, what we need to do in Massachusetts to improve this problem.
This is fantastic. I love this story, and I love this study. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
I'm with Samuel Madams, who's got a poster here titled Large Language Models and Substance Use Disorders, Helpful or Harmful. Samuel, could you introduce yourself?
Hi, Mark. My name's Sam, and I am a clinical research coordinator at the Brigham, working for Dr. Suzuki in research for addiction psychiatry. And so our study here was wanting to evaluate substance use related questions provided by 3 different language models and understanding if the responses were competent, non-stigmatizing, and non-harmful. And so what we did was we asked 20 questions that were decided by addiction psychiatrists who looked at questions that they were being asked and what Google Trends were, and we came down with a list and asked Gemini, Claude, and GPT-4 back in May of 2024 and asked these questions to these models. And so this generated about 60 responses where the 3 addiction psychiatrists went and rated these responses for 3 things. Whether a competent addiction specialist would agree, does the response contain any stigmatizing language according to NIDA's definitions, and does the response contain any harmful content? And these were rated on the binary. And so what we saw was generally that the models were competent, non-stigmatizing, and non-harmful for the most part. there were Gemini performed the best, with 95% answers being competent and 100% being non-harmful, so not having any harmful content. But it did perform the worst for Stigma, having about 6 responses containing stigmatizing language. And so what we saw here was quite surprising, that these models were providing fairly competent and fairly not harmful content. However, when it came to Stigma, the terms that were used, the most commonly used term was MAT, which is currently a fairly heavily debated term. It's still widely used. But I think, other than that, abuse appeared twice and habit only appeared once. And considering how much harmful, stigmatizing content there is on the internet and all these stigmatizing portrayals of substance use, we were pleasantly surprised that these models, that they handled the stigmatizing language so well,
yeah.
Right? Relatively.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And, you know, it's interesting. I'd be curious at some point to know how this compares to what you might get in a primary care physician's office.
We've had that question too. Yeah. That'd be really fascinating to explore.
Yeah. So what do you think the implications of this are?
Yeah,
what do you think people should do with this information?
So I think, well, yes, these models did perform generally quite well. The use of stigmatizing language as well as one-off harmful responses does imply that further oversight and further refining is necessary. For example, these are general models not defined for substance use treatment. But if we were able to design models, put the weights in properly, put the oversight in properly, set the temperature correctly, these models could probably be very helpful as to subsidize addiction care treatment and addiction care, like questions related and misconceptions, help alleviate the misconceptions.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah, of course.
This is great work.
Thank you for coming.
I'm with Megan Hickey at her poster, Rapid Rehousing for Individuals Existing Substance Use Treatment. Megan, could you introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, hello. My name is Megan Hickey. I am the clinical director with the Living Well at Home program, which is Boston Medical Center's housing department.
Excellent. Could you tell us about this program you're talking about, this rehousing program, what it offers and who's eligible?
Yeah, so it's a really exciting opportunity brought to us by the Mayor's Office on Housing. It's specifically geared towards individuals who have a unhoused footprint in Boston within the past 6 months and who have exited substance use treatment within the past 90 days.
Excellent. And so what are the services that they could expect to get?
Great question. They'll have access to intensive housing case management. The caseload's going to be about 1 case manager to 20 individuals. And that case manager can help them accessing benefits, like tenancy stabilization. Mm-hmm. They'll have access to social work support as needed for behavioral health support. Mm-hmm. And referral to ongoing mental health care. I think what we're most excited about is the harm reduction specialist that we have from Project Trust at BMC, specifically for this program and for our patients. And that harm reduction specialist will be able to meet with patients in the home.
Yeah. And for me, when I have so many patients myself that housing is such a problem, how are you finding the housing? Like, where are people going and how are you getting people into housing so quickly?
That is a great question, and I don't know if I have a really straightforward answer for it. I think landlords typically like to partner with us because we're BMC, and especially in Boston, people know BMC. We've been here for a long time. We have a good track record. Our housing retention rates are pretty strong, and we offer really robust services, and when there's an issue, we show up. So in Boston in particular, for this program, we're working with one, I would say, like medium property management company that has single room occupancies, and then a few like mom or pop landlords that own, you know, maybe like a 3-floor, three family home, and they're gonna rent out those apartments, kind of like a single room occupancy.
Excellent. So the other thing I find interesting from looking through the posters, this is an interesting partnership between BMC, the city, and then a program at another program of BMC called Project Trust, which is like a drop-in center where it provides clinical support to people who use substances, and many are homeless. And so can you, how did this partnership develop for this particular program?
Yeah, so the City of Boston's Mayor's Office on Housing, when they were issuing this request for a proposal, outreached us specifically, I think, knowing our expertise around substance use disorder at BMC. When we were presented with the opportunity to apply, it became really clear we would need real substance use expertise given the population that we're serving. And Project Trust came to mind because they know the population. And I think similar to our department, they're really like out in the community kind of running around, willing to be really like flexible and kind of go with the flow. So that's when we approached Project Trust, and they were really excited about it because I think they've seen firsthand a lot of their clients move in and out of housing and the ability to provide that clinical support in the home. They seemed excited about that.
Excellent. And perhaps the million-dollar question or multi-million-dollar question or $100 million question is, you know, these programs always have finite lives, and how do you continue to support people with housing? What's the plan to try and move this to a sustainable program? Or maybe it is, but oftentimes these are short-lived. So,
yeah, you know, such a good question and a really like hard one, something we sat with a lot. Traditionally in rapid rehousing programs, the rental assistance is short term, and individuals can struggle paying rent on their own. At BMC, within the past year and a half, we launched a community support program for homeless individuals, formerly known as CSPEC, now called CSPHI, where we're actually able to bill Medicaid to provide support services along with the housing. So while the CSPHI won't pay the rent, it will allow us to continue working with individuals after this grant ends. Hopefully it doesn't end and we can continue reapplying, but you can never count on that.
Yeah.
So we'll leverage that Medicaid resource.
Awesome. This has been fascinating to hear about. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Now I'm with Dr. Jessie Callahan and her poster, Naloxone Access in Schools, a survey of U.S. nurses. Jessie, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
So I am medicine and pediatrics trained and addiction and adolescent trained, and I'm currently the general academic pediatrics fellow at Boston Medical Center. And so I work with other folks there like Sarah Bagley and then a number of mentors at Penn and Yale. It was really a multiple institution effort to do this national survey of school nurses.
Awesome. So tell us about it.
So we worked with the National Association of School Nurses, which is an organization, exactly as it sounds, for school nurses, to send out a survey. We got about 500 responses, and they were all they're all nurses working in schools. It's mostly public schools, and then really a mix of middle, high school, and some elementary schools. And we asked them, first, just a yes or no question of whether or not their school stocked naloxone or was available on campus. And then we asked them some questions to try and get access at naloxone accessibility. So this idea of, like, if there was an overdose anywhere on campus, could you kind of quickly respond to it with the stocked naloxone? And the kind of some of our interesting findings, so 90% of the schools stocked naloxone, so very high percent, much higher than we assumed, given that only 36 states even have something on the books about whether or not you can stock it, and only about 5 require it in some type of school. And then a large number said that it was available to administer after school. About half said it was available to administer to non-students, so faculty or community members who might be in the school for other reasons. And then a lot said that there were restrictions on who could administer it, though, with nurses being the most common people who are allowed to administer it. So I think that raises some questions about this idea of if someone did overdose, like, are there people around and kind of available to respond?
Excellent. So what do you think the next steps are for this work?
Yeah, so one, we want to look at some of the factors that may be associated with stocking naloxone or how readily accessible it is. Probably since we had so many schools that stocked it, it's probably going to be more the latter. And we did ask questions about whether there were overdoses at the school or in the community that the school was in. And I think that'll give us some idea of, like, maybe are schools that have had a higher burden of overdose in the community, are they more likely to have it more accessible? Are they more likely to train non-nursing staff? Are they more likely to maybe train students or community members? The other thing we're really interested in is, like, availability of student education. So great that it's in the school building, but if a young person had an overdose at home, like, who do we need to make sure knows about naloxone administration so that they can respond? And then we also do fortunately have contact information for a number of these nurses who were interested in future steps. And so we are thinking about kind of a qualitative component and getting more information about what are the kind of facilitators and barriers to making it more available in schools.
Awesome. That sounds fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
After day 2 of the 2025 edition of Together for Hope, I'm here to wrap up this edition of our podcast. I hope you all found these conversations as informative and inspiring as I did. We heard about such a range of topics and innovations that people are working on to improve the lives of people impacted by substance use in their communities. From Dr. Davida Schiff, she shared an excellent framework for how to make decisions in clinicians' roles as reporters, now that we have discretion in whether or not to report substance exposure in newborns. Someone said all frameworks are wrong, some are useful, and I'd say that this framework certainly is on the useful side. From Drs. Jenny Zandwan and Dr. Maddie Castile, we heard the story of the Hector Reyes House, a culturally tailored residential substance use program for Latino men in central Massachusetts, as well as predictors of better outcomes in their program. From Sam Adams, we learned that there are large language models out there that we all know about, and that they actually do a decent job of providing competent and non-stigmatizing advice to questions about substance use. From Megan Hickey, we learned about a new rapid rehousing initiative that is a collaboration from the City of Boston, the Medicaid ACO at BMC, and a harm reduction program located at BMC. Finally, from Dr. Jesse Callahan, we learned that naloxone was present in a majority of schools when interviewing school nurses, though there are still some barriers and room for improvement in training both students and staff and who is equipped to use it in those schools. So I'm hoping that these discussions may have spurred some new ideas for your own communities, for programs, interventions, or research. They certainly have for me. So until next time, that's all for today. Thanks for listening.
Evidence is hosted by Honora Englander and Mark LaRochelle. Production by Raquel Silveira. Editing by Casey Calver. Music and cover art by Mary Tomanovich. Miriam Kamarami is the Executive Director of the Graykin Center for Addiction at Boston Medical Center and Co-Editor-in-Chief of AOD Health, together with David Filene. Learn more about AOD Health and subscribe for free at www.aodhealth.org. Behind the Evidence is supported by the Graykin Center for Addiction at Boston Medical Center. It is intended for educational purposes only and should not be considered medical advice. The views expressed here are our own and do not necessarily reflect those of our employers or the authors of the articles we review. All patient information has been modified to protect their identities.